The fluorescent lights hummed their familiar tune in the basement of the Vatican's secret archives as Joel Vallanthin carefully peeled away centuries-old parchment from its binding. 23 years of manuscript restoration had taught him patience, but today felt different. The morning mist still clung to St. Peter's Dome outside, and down here in the climate-controlled chambers beneath Rome, Joel found himself alone earlier than usual. His fingers, steady from decades of practice, worked methodically through a stack of recently discovered documents. Most were routine, medieval prayers, administrative records, the usual ecclesiastical paperwork that formed the backbone of church history. But then his hand brushed against something that made him pause. Hidden behind a false backing in an ornate 15th-century chest, Joel discovered a leather-bound manuscript that shouldn't exist. No catalog number, no acquisition date, no... just a small handwritten note in Latin taped to the cover. Prohibitum processus non, do not process. The warning should have stopped him. In his years working for the Vatican, Joel had learned to respect such markings. They usually indicated documents too fragile for handling, or materials deemed theologically sensitive. But this manuscript felt different in his hands, heavier than its size suggested, bound in what appeared to be human skin rather than traditional vellum. Forbidden infested Apocrypha, he read aloud from the cover, the hybrid Greek-Latin script causing him to squint under the harsh laboratory lighting. The words seemed to echo strangely in the small room, as if the concrete walls themselves were listening. Joel opened the manuscript carefully, his trained eye immediately recognizing the peculiar blend of ancient Greek and Church Latin that characterized certain esoteric texts. But this was different. The writing style shifted between formal ecclesiastical script and something more primitive, almost scratched into the parchment with desperate urgency. The first section bore a title that made his heart race. Testament of Solomon, the True Binding. As a scholar of ancient texts, Joel knew of Solomon's supposed mastery over demons. The Testament of Solomon was a well-documented pseudepigraphic work, but this version contained details he'd never encountered. Where traditional versions spoke vaguely of Solomon's power, this manuscript provided explicit instructions. To bind Baal, first of the 72, speak his name thrice at the hour of Mars. Joel translated slowly, his voice barely above a whisper. Draw the pentagram with virgin's blood upon stone taken from Jerusalem's temple. The words of binding are thus... What followed was a series of syllables that seemed to twist his tongue as he attempted to pronounce them. The phonetic guides written in the margins suggested sounds that human vocal cords weren't meant to make. Yet as Joel struggled with the pronunciation, he found himself growing more confident, as if something was guiding his understanding. You're doing well, a voice seemed to whisper from somewhere behind his left shoulder. Joel spun around, but the restoration lab remained empty save for the gentle hum of climate control systems. Returning to the manuscript, Joel found the next demon's entry, Agaris. This one commanded 31 legions and could make fugitives return, cause earthquakes, and teach languages. But again, the binding ritual was described in meticulous detail, not just the incantations, but the precise preparation required, the timing, the astronomical configurations necessary for success. Agaris responds to offerings of wine mixed with the bile of a black goat, Joel continued translating, his academic mind struggling to process what he was reading. His seal must be carved into copper with a blade that has tasted innocent blood. The summoner must fast for 7 days, consuming only bread and water blessed by... The text continued with instructions so specific, so detailed, that Joel began to wonder if this wasn't just another medieval fantasy, but something far more dangerous. Each demon's entry contained not just their names and powers, but their weaknesses, their desires, their methods of negotiation. Keep reading, the voice urged. Clearer now. You understand so much more than the others who came before. Joel's hands trembled slightly as he turned the page. Andromalius, the 62nd spirit, appeared before him in intricate detail. This demon was said to catch thieves and discover hidden treasures, but the manuscript went further. It described Andromalius's appearance, a man holding a great serpent, and provided a complete ritual for summoning him. The circle must be drawn with salt blessed on the feast of Saint Michael, Joel read, his voice growing stronger as pronunciation became easier. Place 4 candles at the cardinal points, each carved with the demon's sigil. Burn frankincense mixed with grave dirt, and speak these words of calling. What followed was another string of ancient syllables, but this time, Joel found himself pronouncing them with confidence he didn't understand. The words seemed to flow from his tongue as if he'd spoken them countless times before. "Excellent," the voice praised. "Your pronunciation improves with each attempt. You have a natural gift for the old tongue." "Who's there?" Joel called out, but received no answer except the continued humming of machinery. Turning back to the manuscript, Joel discovered that the Testament of Solomon section contained detailed entries for all 72 demons traditionally associated with the legendary king. But unlike any version he'd studied, this text provided what appeared to be working instructions. Each entry contained precise astronomical timing, specific material requirements, and most disturbing of all, detailed descriptions of what each demon could accomplish for their summoner. Buer, the tenth spirit, could heal all diseases and teach logic and philosophy. His entry described not just how to summon him, but how to negotiate payment, always demanded in years of the summoner's life. Gusian, the 11th, could tell of past, present, and future events, but required the summoner to sacrifice something precious to them personally. As Joel worked through the translations, hours passed without his notice. The voice that had initially startled him became a constant companion, offering pronunciation help and clarifying archaic grammatical structures. Sometimes it would suggest alternative translations that made the text clearer, more actionable. "You see how they bound us," the voice observed as Joel finished translating Paimon's entry. "How they trapped us with words and symbols, forced us to serve those who understood our true names." "Bound who?" Joel asked aloud, his scholarly instincts finally overriding his fascination with the text. "Continue reading," the voice suggested instead of answering. "There is so much more to understand." The final entries in the Testament section dealt with demons Joel had never heard of in traditional sources. Spirits with names like Veltar and Nithaya, beings whose powers seemed to transcend the typical medieval understanding of demonic abilities. These entities could manipulate reality itself, bend time, and peer into dimensions beyond human comprehension. But it was the closing passage of the Testament section that made Joel's blood run cold. "Know this, reader of forbidden words. Solomon's binding was not complete. Many of the 72 found ways to slip their bonds, to work through dreams and whispers, to influence those who possessed knowledge of their true names. This testament serves not as historical record, but as key to locks that should never be opened. Yet for those with courage to seek truth beyond the veil of accepted doctrine, these words provide power beyond mortal imagination." "Now you begin to understand," the voice said with what sounded like satisfaction. "But this is only the beginning. Turn the page, translator. Let us see what other secrets this manuscript holds." Joel's hand hesitated over the next section. His rational mind screamed warnings about the danger of continuing, about the need to report this discovery to his Vatican supervisors. But his scholar's curiosity burned brighter than his caution. The voice had been helpful, guiding him through translations that should have taken weeks to complete. The next section's title made his decision for him: The Gospel of Judas, the Vampiric Truth. As Joel opened to the new section, shadows seemed to gather in the corners of the laboratory, and somewhere in the darkness, he could swear he heard something that sounded remarkably like satisfied laughter. 3 days had passed since Joel first opened the forbidden manuscript, and he hadn't left the restoration laboratory. His colleagues assumed he was working on a particularly complex project. Nothing unusual for the obsessive American scholar who often lost himself in ancient texts. But Joel knew this was different. The voice that guided his translations had become as real to him as his own thoughts, offering insights that transformed incomprehensible symbols into crystal-clear instructions. Sleep had become elusive. Joel found himself dozing fitfully in his chair, waking to find pages of translations he didn't remember writing. His handwriting remained the same, but the knowledge flowing through his pen seemed to come from somewhere beyond his conscious understanding. Coffee cups accumulated on his desk, their contents growing cold as hours passed unnoticed. "Turn the page," the voice urged, its tone carrying an eagerness that hadn't been present before. "The Gospel of Judas awaits. This section will show you truths that the church has buried for nearly 2 millennia. Joel's fingers, now stained with ink from his hurried note-taking, carefully opened to the second major section. The parchment here was darker, almost blood-colored, and the script changed dramatically. Where the Testament of Solomon had been written in formal ecclesiastical style, this section appeared to be scrawled in desperate haste, as if the author feared discovery at any moment. The Gospel of Judas Iscariot, as recorded by Matthias of Antioch, who witnessed the true nature of the betrayer, Joel read aloud, his voice echoing strangely in the empty laboratory. The fluorescent lights seemed to flicker as he spoke, casting moving shadows across the ancient parchment. The opening passage immediately challenged everything Joel thought he knew about biblical history. Know this truth that the church conceals. Judas did not betray the Christ for silver, nor from weakness of faith. Judas betrayed because he had already been claimed by something far older than Rome, something that walked the earth before Abraham drew breath. The betrayer was no longer human when he kissed the Nazarene in Gethsemane. What inhabited his flesh had fed for millennia, waiting for this moment when divine blood would flow upon cursed ground. Continue, the voice whispered with evident satisfaction. Read what Matthias witnessed. See how the transformation began. Joel's hands trembled as he translated the next section, which contained Matthias's first-hand account of discovering Judas's true nature weeks before the crucifixion. The description was so vivid, so detailed, that Joel could almost smell the damp cave air and hear the dying shepherd's final gasps. I followed Judas into the caves outside Bethany, where I witnessed horrors that still plague my dreams 3 decades hence. The man we had traveled with, who had shared our bread and listened to the master's teachings, fed upon the blood of a young shepherd boy. But this was no ordinary violence. Judas's teeth had elongated into fangs sharp as Damascus steel, his eyes glowed with unholy light that hurt to gaze upon, and his skin had taken on a pallor that spoke of death walking among the living. The shepherd boy, no more than 14 summers, had been lured into the depths with promises of silver coins in exchange for information about Roman patrol routes. But as I watched in horror from my hiding place behind fallen stones, Judas pinned the youth against the cave wall with supernatural strength. The feeding was not swift, it was prolonged, ritualistic, as if the act served purposes beyond mere sustenance. As the boy weakened, Judas began speaking in tongues unknown to any Hebrew scholar. The words seemed to twist reality around them, causing shadows to writhe independently of their sources and making the very air thick with malevolent presence. With each syllable, the cave grew colder, and I could see my breath misting in the unnatural chill that surrounded the feeding. The text continued with Matthias's growing horror as he realized that Judas had been transformed into something parasitic, something that could only sustain itself through the consumption of human life force. But the most disturbing revelation came in the following passage, where Matthias described his confrontation with the creature that had once been his fellow disciple. When the shepherd boy breathed his last, Judas turned toward my hiding place, as if he had known of my presence all along. His smile revealed teeth still stained with innocent blood, and his voice, when he spoke, carried harmonics that no human throat should produce. Matthias of Antioch, he said, though I had told him neither my birthplace nor my lineage, you have witnessed the sustenance of the eternal. Come forth from the shadows and learn truths that will reshape your understanding of creation itself. When I remained hidden, paralyzed by terror, Judas laughed, a sound like wind through bone caverns. I know your thoughts, scribe. You wonder how long I have been other than human. The transformation began the night I first touched the silver pieces, 3 moons past. Each coin bore inscriptions in the old tongue, words that called to something ancient that had been waiting in the spaces between worlds. Compelled by forces beyond my comprehension, I found myself stepping into the open. Judas studied me with those terrible glowing eyes, and I felt his gaze penetrating not just my flesh, but my very soul. The masters I serve predate your Hebrew God by eons uncounted, he continued, his voice now overlaid with whispers in languages that hurt my mind to hear. They walked between stars when this world was nothing but cosmic dust, and they will continue long after the final human draws breath. The silver pieces were not payment for betrayal, but tokens of binding, each coin inscribed with symbols that would complete my transformation and open pathways for my masters to enter your reality. You see the pattern emerging? The voice observed as Joel paused to rub his tired eyes. The laboratory had grown uncomfortably warm despite the climate control, and sweat beaded on his forehead as he worked. Throughout history, they have worked through those who possessed knowledge of the old words, the binding names. Just as they work through you now, Joel felt a chill despite the heat. What do you mean, work through me? Continue reading, the voice urged, evading his question. Understanding will come with knowledge. Joel turned the page and found detailed descriptions of Judas's vampiric abilities. Unlike the folklore vampires of medieval legend, this version of Judas could assume multiple forms, manipulate shadows, and most terrifyingly, create others like himself through a complex ritual that involved not just blood consumption, but the speaking of specific incantations in the old tongue. The creation of progeny requires 7 nights of preparation under specific stellar alignments, Joel translated, his voice growing steadier as the pronunciation came more naturally. The chosen vessel must first be drained completely during the dark of the moon, then fed upon blood mixed with wine blessed in the name of the unnamed ones. As the vessel drinks, the creator must speak the words of unmaking, releasing the soul from divine protection and binding it to the eternal hunger that drives all children of the void. The words of unmaking are not merely spoken, but carved into the flesh of both creator and progeny, using implements forged from metal touched by starlight. Each syllable must be pronounced with perfect precision, for even the slightest mispronunciation will result in the destruction of both participants. The ritual concludes when the new vampire speaks its true name in the old tongue, sealing its transformation and announcing its allegiance to the masters who dwell beyond the veil. The words of unmaking that followed were written in the same twisted script Joel had encountered in the Testament section. As he attempted to pronounce them, the voice provided guidance, correcting his emphasis and helping him navigate the linguistic complexities. The words seemed to resonate in his chest, creating vibrations that felt almost physical. Perfect pronunciation, the voice praised, its tone carrying a satisfaction that made Joel uneasy. You have such natural talent for the old tongue. Your academic training serves you well, but there is something more, an innate understanding that suggests you were meant for this work. But there is more to discover. Turn to Matthias's final entries about the betrayal. The concluding passages of the Gospel of Judas section contained Matthias's account of the betrayal itself, but from a perspective that cast the crucifixion in an entirely different light. According to this version, Matthias had followed Judas to Gethsemane and witnessed the kiss that would damn the world. The kiss in Gethsemane was not mere identification for the Roman soldiers, though it served that mundane purpose as well. It was the completion of a ritual that had begun months earlier when Judas first accepted the silver pieces. Through that kiss, Judas transferred something into the Christ. Not corruption, for the Nazarene was protected by his divine nature, but a connection that would allow Judas's masters to touch the divine realm itself. I watched from the olive trees as Judas approached the praying figure of our master. The very air around the betrayer shimmered with malevolent energy, and I could see shadows moving independently of any physical form. As Judas's lips touched the Christ's cheek, lightning flashed across a cloudless sky, and for one terrible moment, I glimpsed something vast and hungry pressing against the barriers of reality. The crucifixion became not salvation for mankind, but an opportunity for ancient powers to taste the blood of divinity. Every drop that fell from the cross was collected by invisible hands, carried away to feed entities whose very existence challenged the natural order. The resurrection 3 days hence was genuine. The divine nature could not be permanently destroyed, but the damage had been done. A pathway had been opened, a connection established between the earthly realm and dimensions that should remain forever sealed. The church understood the danger, the voice explained as Joel finished the section, its tone growing more intimate and conspiratorial. That is why they rewrote the story, why they portrayed Judas as a simple traitor motivated by greed. The truth was too dangerous to preserve in official doctrine. But some texts survived, hidden away in places like this, waiting for those with the wisdom to understand their significance. Joel closed his eyes and leaned back in his chair. The implications of what he'd translated challenged fundamental Christian doctrine, but the scholarly part of his mind couldn't deny the text's authenticity. The manuscript showed clear signs of extreme age, and the linguistic patterns were consistent with first-century Aramaic translated into Church Latin. The level of detail, the consistency of the narrative voice, the historical references that checked against known sources, all of it suggested authenticity. But more troubling was how natural the translation process had become. Words that should have taken hours to decipher were flowing from his pen with alarming ease. Complex grammatical structures that typically required extensive consultation with reference works were unfolding in his mind like familiar melodies. "What are you?" Joel asked aloud, his voice barely above a whisper. "And why can I understand things I've never studied?" "I am one who remembers," the voice replied, its tone growing warmer, almost paternal. "One who was present when these words were first written. Who watched as Matthias scratched his testimony onto parchment with trembling hands. I have waited centuries for a translator with both the skill and the open mind necessary to understand these truths. Continue reading, translator. The Book of Enoch's visions will show you the war that preceded all human history, the conflict that shaped the very nature of reality itself." With growing trepidation and undeniable curiosity, Joel opened to the third major section of the manuscript. The title page bore elaborate illuminations depicting winged figures locked in combat across a starlit sky. But these weren't the traditional depictions of angels and demons from medieval art. These beings appeared more alien, more primordial, with anatomical features that defied human understanding. Some had too many eyes, others possessed limbs that bent in impossible directions, and all radiated a sense of power that made Joel's eyes water to look upon them directly. "The Book of Enoch's Visions, The War Before Time, as revealed to the seventh generation from Adam," Joel read, his voice now carrying a confidence that surprised him. The words seemed to flow more easily with each page, as if the act of translation was somehow training his mind for greater comprehension. This section began with Enoch's account of being taken up into the heavens, but unlike the canonical version that had survived in Ethiopian Christianity, this text provided explicit details about what he witnessed in the celestial realms. "I was brought before the throne of judgment not by gentle messengers, but by beings of such terrible beauty that mortal eyes could scarcely comprehend their forms. They moved through dimensions as easily as fish swim through water, and their voices spoke in harmonics that bypassed the ears entirely, resonating directly within the soul. Before the throne, I beheld the true nature of the war that preceded creation. The beings called angels were not the pure spirits of later doctrine, but powerful entities from dimensions beyond human comprehension. Some remained loyal to the Creator's vision of ordered reality, while others sought to impose their own will upon the forming cosmos. The conflict was not born of pride or disobedience, but of fundamental disagreements about the nature of existence itself." "Enoch saw the rebellion as it truly happened," the voice commented, its tone growing excited. "Not the simplified tale of pride and disobedience that survived in approved scripture, but the complex reality of cosmic politics and dimensional warfare." Joel continued translating, discovering that Enoch's account described the rebellious angels not as fallen beings seeking to corrupt humanity, but as entities with their own vision for creation. They possessed knowledge of fundamental forces: time, space, matter manipulation, consciousness itself, that they intended to use for purposes the Creator had not sanctioned. The leader of the rebellion was not Lucifer, as later texts would claim, but one whose true name cannot be spoken without consequence, Joel read, feeling a strange reluctance to continue that he pushed through with effort. This entity, known only as the Unnamed, sought to unravel the very fabric of creation and rebuild it according to patterns that would allow his kind to rule unopposed. Where the Creator envisioned a reality of growth and change, the Unnamed desired stasis and control. Where divine law promoted free will, the rebels sought absolute dominion over consciousness itself. The war lasted for eons beyond human measurement, fought not with swords and fire, but with words of power that could reshape reality at its most fundamental level. Entire dimensions were born and destroyed in single battles. Stars were kindled as weapons and extinguished as casualties. The very concepts of time and space became battlegrounds where opposing forces struggled for supremacy. The text went on to describe specific battles in this cosmic war, providing names for angelic combatants that Joel had never encountered in any canonical or apocryphal source. There was Rashiel, who commanded legions of beings made from living light and whose voice could ignite nebulae across vast reaches of space. Themeriel, whose songs could shatter the foundations of existence itself, causing reality to forget its own laws. Zerachiel, master of temporal flows, who could trap enemies in loops of causality that lasted for eternity while appearing to last only moments. These are the true names, the voice whispered with evident excitement. Names that still carry power, still respond to proper pronunciation. Names that those in authority have worked for millennia to suppress and forget. But it was Enoch's description of the war's conclusion that made Joel's blood run cold and his hands pause in their translation. Victory belonged to neither side in complete measure. The Creator's forces prevailed in that the rebels were prevented from completely unmaking reality. But the cost was beyond calculation. The Creator bound the rebels with words of infinite complexity, imprisoning them in dimensions beyond the reach of physical reality. These binding words became the foundation of natural law itself. Gravity, electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear forces, all expressions of the cosmic imprisonment that keeps the rebels contained. But the binding was not perfect, could not be perfect, for the rebels had learned to fragment themselves during the long war. They had discovered how to hide portions of their essence in the spaces between words, in the silence between heartbeats, in the gaps between thoughts. While their primary forms were imprisoned beyond dimensional barriers, these fragments remained free to whisper and influence and slowly corrupt. The unnamed, greatest of the rebels, had scattered himself most completely of all. His fragments dwelt in every shadow, every moment of doubt, every word spoken in anger or despair. He could not act directly, but he could guide and suggest and slowly turn willing minds toward the work of undoing the bonds that held him. Joel paused, his head spinning from the implications. According to this version of Enoch's visions, the defeated angels hadn't been cast into a simple hell, but scattered across dimensional barriers, waiting for opportunities to influence reality through those who possessed knowledge of their true names. Now you begin to understand the purpose of these texts, the voice said, its tone growing more intimate. Solomon's Testament, the true story of Judas, Enoch's complete visions. They are keys to understanding how we can still reach across the barriers that bind us. How those with sufficient knowledge can become conduits for powers beyond mortal comprehension. We? Joel asked again, though part of him already suspected the answer. The voice had become so familiar, so helpful, that he had begun to think of it as a friend, rather than an intruder in his mind. Continue reading, the voice urged instead of responding directly. The final entries in Enoch's section will prepare you for what comes next. They will show you prophecies of the time when the barriers weaken and the old knowledge returns to the world. The concluding passages of the Book of Enoch's visions contained prophecies that spoke of a time when the barriers between dimensions would weaken, when those with sufficient knowledge could use the old words to call across the void. In the last days, when humanity has forgotten the true history of the war, when the church has buried the dangerous knowledge beneath layers of comfortable doctrine, the scattered fragments will begin to gather. The binding words that serve as natural law will start to weaken as fewer beings remember their true purpose. Those who speak the old words with proper understanding will become conduits, allowing the bound ones to touch reality once more. Through willing vessels, through minds opened by knowledge and curiosity, the great work of unmaking and remaking can finally be completed. The unnamed will gather his scattered essence and rise again to challenge the order that has constrained him for so long. But this rising will not come through force or violence, for such methods invite resistance. Instead, it will come through persuasion and seduction, through the offer of knowledge and power to those wise enough to recognize opportunity. Scholars and scribes, translators and interpreters, these will be the unwitting servants of the new age. Their very dedication to understanding making them perfect instruments of change. And now you understand your purpose, the voice said with unmistakable satisfaction. You, Joel Valanthin, have been chosen to be such a vessel. Your skill with languages, your scholarly dedication, your willingness to pursue forbidden knowledge despite warnings, all of this has led you to this moment. You are not merely translating these texts. You are participating in their resurrection, breathing new life into words that have waited centuries for the right voice to speak them. Joel's hands shook as he turned to the final section of the manuscript. The title page was blank except for a single line written in script so ancient he could barely recognize the letter forms. the true names of the enemies of God. Speak and be answered. Yes, the voice whispered with evident hunger. Now we reach the heart of the matter. This final section contains the most dangerous knowledge of all. The binding names that can call across dimensional barriers. The words that can wake what sleeps and free what has been imprisoned. Read these names, translator. Understand their power. And perhaps, if you prove worthy, I will show you wonders beyond your wildest academic dreams. Joel's transformation over the past week hadn't gone unnoticed. Father Benedetti, the Vatican Archives supervisor, had knocked on the Restoration Laboratory door twice, receiving only muffled responses about complex linguistic challenges and requiring uninterrupted concentration. Joel's colleagues whispered in the corridors about the American scholar who seemed to have become a hermit, surviving on vending machine coffee and the occasional sandwich brought by concerned junior archivists. But Joel was beyond caring about appearances. The voice, his constant companion now, had revealed truths that made mundane concerns seem trivial. Sleep came in brief, fitful moments, often interrupted by dreams filled with ancient symbols and whispered names in languages that predated human civilization. "Today, we complete the work," the voice announced as Joel opened the manuscript to its final section. "Today, you will understand the full scope of what awaits those brave enough to speak the old words." The page before him contained a list unlike anything in his decades of manuscript study. Where previous sections had been written in standard ancient scripts, these names were carved into the parchment itself, each letter gouged deep enough to create actual grooves in the material. The ink filling these grooves appeared black in normal light, but seemed to shimmer with deep purple undertones when viewed from certain angles. "The true names of the enemies of God," Joel read aloud, his voice now completely steady despite the magnitude of what lay before him. "Compiled by the Scribe of Shadows, witnessed by those who dared to listen when the bound ones called across the void." The introduction to this section made clear its dangerous nature. "Know, reader, that these are not merely names but keys. Each syllable carries power accumulated across eons of imprisonment. To speak these names with understanding is to open doorways that divine will sought to keep forever sealed. The translator who reads these words aloud will become a beacon in the darkness, a lighthouse calling home those who have wandered lost between dimensions. Proceed only if you are prepared to accept the consequences of such knowledge. For once these names are spoken with proper pronunciation, there can be no return to ignorance. The old powers will know you, will mark you as one of their own, and will expect service in exchange for the gifts they bestow. Do not hesitate now," the voice urged, its tone carrying both encouragement and subtle threat. "You have come too far to retreat into comfortable ignorance. Speak the first name, translator. Let us test your pronunciation." Joel's eyes fell upon the first entry in the list. The name was written in characters that seemed to shift slightly when he wasn't looking directly at them, as if the letters themselves were alive and restless. Vethkaran, the Unbound, first among the scattered, master of whispers between worlds. His name opens the smallest cracks in reality, allowing communication across dimensional barriers. Below the description were phonetic guides more complex than any Joel had encountered. The pronunciation required not just specific sounds, but particular breathing patterns, tongue positions that felt unnatural, and vocal modulations that seemed to bypass normal speech entirely. "Begin," the voice commanded. "Speak my true name, faithful translator." The realization hit Joel like a physical blow, like a, "You're Vethkaran." "I am a fragment of him," the voice replied with evident satisfaction. "For 7 centuries, I have dwelt in the spaces between thoughts, waiting for a mind capable of bridging the gap between imprisonment and freedom. You, Joel Valanthan, possess the linguistic skills and academic obsession necessary to serve as my voice in your reality." Despite the revelation, Joel found himself unable to resist. The name seemed to pull at his consciousness, demanding to be spoken. As he began the complex pronunciation, the laboratory around him changed. The fluorescent lights dimmed to a sickly amber glow, and shadows gathered in corners where none should exist. The temperature dropped precipitously, causing his breath to mist as he spoke. "Vethkaran, Anthel, Mordeth." With each syllable, The presence in his mind grew stronger, more defined. What had been whispers became a clear voice. What had been suggestions became commands. Joel felt his sense of self being slowly but steadily displaced by something ancient and patient and utterly alien. "Excellent!" Vethkaren's voice now rang clear as a bell in Joel's consciousness. "The first barrier is broken. Now, continue with the others. Each name you speak will strengthen the connection, will make it possible for more of my kind to touch your world." The second name belonged to Nithal the Corruptor, whose domain was the slow poison of doubt and despair. As Joel pronounced it, he felt a creeping certainty that everything he had believed about reality was fundamentally wrong. The third name, Zelmaran the Timerender, brought with it a nauseating sense of temporal displacement, as if past and future were colliding in the present moment. "Feel the power flowing through you," Vethkaren urged as Joel continued down the list. "With each name, you become more than merely human. You become a conduit for forces that shaped the cosmos before your species drew breath." The names continued, each more complex than the last. Thulgarath the Voidcaller, whose pronunciation made Joel's vision fill with impossible geometries. Morvenith the Dreamwalker, whose name opened pathways between sleeping and waking consciousness. Kethmurin the Flesh Twister, whose syllables made Joel acutely aware of his own mortality and the arbitrary nature of physical form. As he worked through the list, Joel became increasingly aware that he was no longer alone in the laboratory. Shadows moved independently of any light source, and he could swear he heard whispered conversations in languages that hurt his mind to process. The manuscript itself seemed to respond to his reading, the parchment growing warm under his hands, and the carved letters beginning to glow with that same purple radiance he had noticed earlier. "The barriers weaken with each name," Vethkaren explained, his mental voice now completely dominating Joel's thoughts. "Soon, others of my kind will be able to cross over more completely. But first, we need a more permanent anchor in your reality. Something more substantial than whispered words and translated texts." "What do you mean?" Joel asked, though he continued reading even as he questioned. "Turn the page," Vethkaren commanded. "Beyond the names lies something far more valuable than knowledge. Beyond the names lies power itself." Joel turned to the final page of the manuscript and gasped. Embedded in the parchment was a small obsidian amulet, perfectly round and covered with inscriptions, so minute they seemed to have been etched by inhuman tools. The stone radiated cold that he could feel even without touching it, and staring at it too long made his eyes water and his head pound. "The Seal of Binding," Vethkaren whispered with reverence. "Created during the First War, used to imprison my kind beyond dimensional barriers. But like all tools of binding, it can be turned to purposes of release. With proper preparation and the right words of power, this seal can tear open permanent doorways between worlds." Joel reached toward the amulet, then hesitated. Some rational part of his mind still functioned, still recognized the magnitude of what was being asked of him. "What happens to me if I take it?" "You become my permanent vessel," Vethkaren replied with complete honesty. "Your consciousness will merge with mine, your knowledge combining with my ancient wisdom. You will see wonders beyond human imagination, wield power that mortals can only dream of possessing. But you will no longer be entirely human." The offer hung in the air between them. Joel stared at the amulet, feeling its pull like gravity itself. Every fiber of his scholarly being craved the knowledge it represented, the ultimate translation project that would unlock secrets hidden since before recorded history. "But I offer you choice," Vethkaren continued, his mental voice becoming almost seductive. "Take only the manuscript. Flee this place before your supervisors discover what you have been reading. I will guide you to other locations, other caches of forbidden knowledge. Together, we will gather the scattered texts needed to weaken the barriers that separate the dimensions." "Other manuscripts?" Joel asked, his voice barely above a whisper. "Hidden in monasteries across Europe. Buried in the archives of institutions that do not understand what they possess. Scattered fragments of the old knowledge, waiting to be reunited by one with the skill to understand their significance. You could become the greatest translator in human history, the scholar who resurrects entire libraries of forbidden wisdom." The temptation was overwhelming. Joel had dedicated his life to the preservation and understanding of ancient texts. The possibility of discovering caches of previously unknown manuscripts was everything he had ever dreamed of achieving. "But decide quickly," Vethkaren urged. "I sense movement in the corridors above. Your absence has been noted, and soon investigators will come seeking answers. Take the manuscript and flee, or remain here and watch as they destroy what you have worked so hard to understand." As if summoned by the entity's words, Joel heard footsteps echoing in the hallway outside the laboratory. Voices speaking in concerned Italian, growing closer with each passing moment. Father Benedetti's distinctive tenor rising above the others, expressing worry about the American scholar who had been isolated for too long. Joel's hands moved without conscious decision. The manuscript, despite its apparent age and fragility, proved surprisingly easy to close and lift. He slipped it into his leather satchel along with his translation notes, his movements quick and efficient despite the magnitude of what he was doing. "The amulet," Vethkaren insisted. "Do not leave behind such a powerful tool." Joel hesitated for only a moment before prying the obsidian seal from its embedding in the final page. The stone was warm to the touch despite its apparent coldness, and he could feel it pulsing with a rhythm that matched his heartbeat. He dropped it into his jacket pocket, just as the laboratory door began to open. "Dr. Valanthin?" Father Benedetti's voice called out in accented English. "Are you well? We have been concerned..." But Joel was already moving toward the emergency exit at the back of the laboratory, a rarely used stairway that led directly to the Vatican's service tunnels. His years working in the archives had taught him alternate routes through the complex, knowledge that now served purposes its instructors had never intended. "Yes," Vethkaren whispered with evident satisfaction as Joel slipped into the darkened stairwell. "Now we begin the true work. I will guide you to places of power, to repositories of knowledge that will make today's discoveries seem like children's primers. Together, we will gather the tools needed to tear down the barriers between worlds." Joel paused on the stairs, looking back toward the laboratory where he had spent so many productive years. In that moment, he felt the weight of what he was abandoning. His career, his reputation, his comfortable life as a respected Vatican scholar. But the pull of the manuscript in his satchel and the voice in his mind were stronger than any attachment to his former existence. "Do not look back," Vethkaren commanded softly. "The past is ending, translator. The future belongs to those brave enough to speak the old words and wake the powers that sleep. Come, let me show you wonders that will make your previous scholarly achievements seem like dust in comparison." Joel Valanthin, former Vatican manuscript restorer, turned away from his old life and followed the voice deeper into the tunnels beneath Rome. Behind him, concerned voices called his name, but he no longer answered to those sounds. He belonged to something older now, something that had waited centuries for the right mind to help it cross the barriers between dimensions. The obsidian amulet pulsed against his chest with each heartbeat, a cold reminder of powers beyond human comprehension. The manuscript in his satchel contained names that could reshape reality itself. And in his mind, Vethkaren the Unbound whispered promises of knowledge and power beyond imagining. Soon, the entity promised as they emerged into the Roman night, "My scattered brethren will be free, and you, faithful translator, will be the instrument of their liberation. The old words will be spoken again, the true names will resonate across dimensions, and reality itself will remember what it has forgotten." Joel smiled as he disappeared into the shadows of the Eternal City, no longer entirely human, no longer bound by the limitations of mortal understanding. The forbidden-infested Apocrypha had found its perfect reader, and the ancient powers stirred in their dimensional prisons, sensing that their long wait for freedom was finally nearing its end.